From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We felt like there was enough evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was guilty of conspiracy. How much involvement that was very much debated. And there were a lot of different views about that among the jurors for how involved he was, all the way from a very tiny amount to totally.
So how much do we know about who bombed the Oklahoma City Federal Building? A profile of Mexican Bishop Samuel Ruiz and women in Cuba. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Clinton administration and the International Monetary Fund, alarmed by Asia's deepening economic crisis, are sending top officials to Indonesia to help right a faltering bailout effort. Both the White House and the International Monetary Fund emphasized their emissaries would underscore to the Indonesian dictator Suharto the urgent need for his government to adhere to the reform pledges it made in November to qualify for a $40 billion rescue package. President Clinton made a personal appeal to Suharto in a 20-minute phone call last night from Air Force One. Suharto pledged his support to Clinton for IMF-backed reform, according to a senior minister in Jakarta today. Theodore Kaczynski is in the Unabomber's Vision of Hell, hooked to an electronic heart monitor in a cell for the suicidal, a camera watching his every move. Kaczynski's mental health, the issue he's fought so hard to avoid, is at center stage in his strange case, a day after authorities say he tried to hang himself with his underwear and then sought permission to defend himself at a murder trial where he's accused of being the anti-technology Unabomber. Prosecutors and defense attorneys were to confer today with psychiatrists who will examine Kaczynski. They must report to the court on whether he's competent to stand trial at all and whether he can represent himself. Only minutes before the presentations were to start again yesterday, Kaczynski said he'd rather defend himself than submit to his attorney's mental defect defense. He delayed the trial Monday by trying to fire the lawyers. Outside court, defense attorney Judy Clark denied her client is sabotaging the trial. An advisor to Palestinian President Yasser Arafat said today U.S. envoy Dennis Ross has failed to achieve progress on deadlock peace talks with Israel, adding all the series of meetings and contacts with Ross are without any result. He accused Israel's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, of working to destroy the peace process. Here in the United States, Ramzi Youssef was sentenced to life in prison for the 1994 bombing of a Philippines airliner and 240 years for masterminding the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. The judge, calling him an apostle of evil, recommended he be kept in solitary confinement. Youssef declared at the hearing, "Yes, I am a terrorist, and I am proud of it." This news from Dallas. The tobacco industry has offered the state of Texas $14.5 billion over 25 years to settle its lawsuit filed to recoup money spent on six smokers. This according to the Dallas Morning News. Last June, the tobacco industry agreed to pay $368 billion and curb their marketing practices in a deal to settle 40 pending state lawsuits. In return, the industry would get immunity from future lawsuits. But Congress must approve any deal. After the national agreement was announced, Florida and Mississippi reached their own multi-million-dollar settlements over health care costs. A trial on the same issue in Minnesota is scheduled to begin January 20th. Despite suspicions by some African-American leaders, the Justice Department has no plans to formally investigate the 1996 death of Commerce Secretary Ron Brown. Brown and 34 others died when the Air Force jet carrying them crashed in a rainstorm in Croatia. Justice Department officials say they've reviewed the matter and conclude at this time there's no crime. Questions have been raised among some black leaders about a wound on Brown's head that reportedly resembles a bullet hole and an Air Force pathologist's complaints about the investigation. But military officials have ruled out the possibility Brown was shot. Oprah Winfrey is finally talking about mad cow disease and beef again. She says in a federal court deposition that she has virtually sworn off eating beef since her talk show ran a dangerous food segment. She says she rarely ate beef even before the 1996 show. The episode triggered a federal defamation lawsuit by Texas cattlemen. It names Winfrey and an anti-meat advocate who voiced concerns about mad cow disease possibly appearing in the United States. The cattlemen claim more than $12 million in losses. Until now, Winfrey had refused all comment on the controversial program. A federal judge has postponed the election for the Teamsters Union president so candidate James P. Hoffa's finances can be thoroughly investigated. The decision came in response to a petition by an overseer for more time to look into Hoffa's 1996 bid for the presidency. The protest was filed by the Ron Kerry campaign before Kerry's reelection victory was thrown out. And that's some of the news. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to all of our listeners out there.
Well, Juan, it looks like the Indonesian currency has nearly collapsed.
Yes, yesterday was perhaps the worst day in Indonesia's history. The rupiah, the currency there, which was trading at about 2,500 to the dollar as recently as August, it reached down to 10,000 to the dollar, and there was panic buying in the streets by people. And there was an emergency meeting of the top Clinton administration officials last night to try to figure out what to do about the continuing crisis in Asia, which is spreading from one nation to another. It's a domino situation. It's not even a domino situation because it goes back and forth from one country to another. And as I've been saying on this show now for several months, the stock market crash that we had in October was indeed a much bigger crash than economists here have been attempting to tell the American people. And now we're seeing the results with the country that is really threatened now. Behind this is Japan. And, of course, Japan is the banker to the world. Most of the biggest banks in the world are Japanese banks. And the pressure on those banks and the situation in Japan, if it reaches there, which and Japan is already in a deep recession, then you really will have a world financial crisis that nobody can avoid.
And back on Indonesia, with the currency collapsing, it's also very interesting to look at, and we will in the coming days, the Indonesian political response as well, because political turmoil is already expressing itself. That is an Indonesian dictatorship, and this does not help Suharto stay in power.
Well, and Suharto was expecting to declare for another run for the presidency in March, but now there appears to be pressure from the United States as well and concerns about whether he should run because he announced a new budget just a couple of days ago. This is what touched off the current problems, where he was supposed to declare, according to the IMF, an austerity budget, and he did not declare an austerity budget because he was afraid of the political reaction from the population of as many as 2 million more Indonesians being thrown on the streets unemployed.
And it's pretty sad that this is what it takes the United States to question whether he should be president again or even to talk about the sham elections they have, considering he's responsible for, well, close to 1 million deaths between Indonesia proper and when he came to power in 65 and East Timor, which Indonesia occupies. Well, we'll certainly follow that as we move along. But right now, we're going to take a look at something closer to home, and it is the story of the Terry Nichols case. The jury forewoman who denounced the Oklahoma City bombing investigation has plenty to criticize and plenty of critics as well. Fellow jurors, the attorney general, and relatives of the dead. Now someone has threatened to blow up her house. Nikki Deutschman, a 47-year-old obstetrics nurse, told police she received a series of bomb threats after telling reporters she believed the government botched the case by ignoring evidence and failing to follow up leads. Deutschman said she received three calls Wednesday evening from a man who threatened to blow up the house. Federal authorities would only confirm her report. Deutschman declined interview yesterday. Hours before the threats, the seven women and five men who convicted Terry Nichols of conspiracy and involuntary manslaughter were dismissed after failing to decide on a sentence. The impasse spared Nichols a death sentence. Right after that impasse was announced, Nikki Deutschman held a news conference.
We felt like there was enough evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was guilty of conspiracy. How much involvement that was, was very much debated, and there were a lot of different views about that among the jurors for how involved he was, all the way from a very tiny amount to totally.
And that was Nikki Deutschman, the jury forewoman in the Terry Nichols case. In this segment of the show, we're going to talk to Chip Berlay. Chip Berlay is a senior analyst with Political Research Associates, which is based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He also was subpoenaed to participate in the sentencing phase of the Terry Nichols trial, although ultimately he was never called. He joins us on the phone now from Massachusetts. Welcome, Chip Berlay.
Hello.
Well, can you tell us what we have learned so far? I mean, what this seems to raise, the question it seems to raise, and one that Nikki Deutschman talked about, is who really was responsible for, in addition to Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bombing?
Well, I think it's important to understand that from the beginning, the indictment and other documents suggested that there were others involved than Mr. McVeigh and Mr. Nichols. And it's important to note, if there were others involved, it still means the government can put McVeigh and Nichols on trial. But having said that, yes, I think it's pretty clear that there is a lot of evidence introduced in the case that suggests that there might have been other people involved. Now, before we set off a raft of conspiracists thinking about this, that's common in these kinds of cases. The issue, I think, is not so much for me that there were others involved and the government failed to track them down, although that's a serious issue. The issue for me is that in terms of this case, the FBI engaged in, which I think, kind of activities which were accurately characterized by the juror, although that's not shared across the jury. It's outrageous that the FBI does not tape record its interviews of witnesses. It is arrogance. Some of the allegations were just plain refuted in the course of the case. There were phone calls that were allegedly made by Mr. Nichols, and the defense was able to parade before the jurors a number of people who received those phone calls saying that they may have come from Nichols' phone or from his phone card, but they spoke to Timothy McVeigh. And then there's the issue of if you were the prosecutor, who would you have put on trial in this case, Mr. Fortier or Mr. Nichols? You know, who should have been the defendant and who should have been the witness in this case?
And what do you think message was the jury sending in terms of what it believed? You say that there were clearly differences among the jurors.
Well, the jurors have said, or some of the jurors said, that there were three distinct pools of people that ranged from let the judge decide to the death penalty to we should decide on a lesser charge. This is a case made up of circumstantial evidence. You could argue that, and I've read a large portion of the transcript of this trial, a reasonable jury could have let him go or convicted him on all counts. That's the problem with this kind of circumstantial evidence. It's how much do you believe the narrative of the prosecution in regards to what the evidence means. So what you have here is a jury made up of people who looked at circumstantial evidence and reached very different conclusions, although no juror, it has been said by many of the jurors, was willing to just cut him loose.
And what do you think in terms of the FBI long term? How has it come out of both of these cases now in terms of its reputation as the premier investigatory and law enforcement group in the country?
Well, as someone who has been a paralegal in lawsuits against the FBI for chronic misconduct and deception and surveillance abuse, you know, obviously I don't think the FBI went into this case with a very good reputation, and from my view it comes out with that bad reputation unsullied.
Let me ask you, Chip Berlay of Political Research Associates, since this is a case you have followed so extensively, we have the FBI, what they call the jurors, the arrogance of the FBI and the problems of the whole investigation. And then you have the people that the FBI decided to use as witnesses versus go after, like Terry Nichols. What about the Fortiers, and what is your idea about their role in the Oklahoma City bombing?
Well, I think just from what's been made public, that if I were a prosecutor, I would have put Mr. Fortier on trial and maybe considered Mr. Nichols as a witness. I think that throughout the FBI's history, it has had a problem of latching onto informers who have a questionable track record in relationship to the truth. Clearly, Mr. Fortier's testimony in the McVeigh trial and his testimony in the Nichols trial don't match, and that certainly raises issues of whether or not somebody might suggest that there was perjury. I think the FBI got hold of someone who was not very reliable, and this is not the first time that has happened, and they quickly turned him as the informer in the case and failed to unravel the larger conspiracy.
So where does this leave the investigation? Are we expecting to see any other people who will be indicted in the Oklahoma City bombing case?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. There certainly is a grand jury sitting right now in Oklahoma City. Some of the allegations that have been made that led to that grand jury certainly fall into the realm of kind of fantasy conspiracy thinking. But there is a lot of data, witnesses and evidence that suggests that there were a number of other people involved in at least mixing and conveying the materials for the bomb. So we'll see. We'll see what the indictment from Oklahoma says. Remember now that Nichols was indicted in the under federal charges for the 8 deaths of the federal employees. That leaves 160 potential indictments, or actually 160 people who died whose cases can be dealt with in Oklahoma with multiple indictments. So when the Oklahoma City grand jury comes down with its indictments, we'll see what they think of things.
And in your close scrutiny of the testimony in both trials, do you have any sense or any opinion as to whether the folks who were involved were linked to any broader organization, or was this a lone maverick outfit in the extreme right in the U.S.?
Well, it's pretty clear that McVeigh and Nichols both come out of the Patriot movement, but let's be distinct here. McVeigh clearly was in the neo-Nazi underground. He in letters that he wrote, in the material that he passed out, he had a neo-Nazi kind of link, and it is clear from some statements that are made by some people that he was part of a group. He had joined people in this neo-Nazi underground. Nichols, on the other hand, appears to be sort of a vanilla variety patriot constitutionalist. And although there are white supremacist and anti-Semitic roots to that movement, I don't think that Nichols embraced them or even aware of them. He was just, you know, angry at the government and willing to adopt these conspiracist theories about the economy and the law. So, yes, there is a much larger group of people out there. Let's be clear now that the government used the idea that somehow the entire militia movement was behind the Oklahoma City bombing and also the supposed terrorist bombing of the TWA flight to pass sweeping and repressive legislation, anti-terrorism legislation, which has curtailed each and every one of our individual civil liberties in this country. And that was a hoax. The TWA flight was not bombed, and the militia movement, now through the testimony in both trials, certainly had some relationship in terms of gun shows and sales of this survivalist-type material to McVeigh and Nichols, but there was no real militia link shown in either case. So we've managed to been sucker-punched by the federal government in this case.
And what about the continuing effects afterwards now on the militia movement and the other extreme right organizations or groups in the U.S. Has this has this helped to fractionalize them or to dissipate them, or have they just become more secretive in the way they operate?
Well, I think they've become more secretive. There's certainly the bombing did drive a wedge into the movement, sort of dividing between those people who are willing to consider acts of violence into one camp and those who were not into another. Clearly, the social and cultural and economic conditions that led to the rise of the Patriot movement and the armed militia movement are still there. There is still a neo-Nazi underground in this country and a neo-Nazi movement. Right-wing populism continues to grow. These groups, I think, are biding their time, but I don't think they've gone away by any means.
And is your sense that the FBI is hounding them, or is basically satisfied with what it's done so far and just monitoring them now?
Well, I'm dissatisfied with most of what the FBI does when it comes to dissidents of both the left and the right. The FBI clearly, in some cases, has inserted informers into some of these groups and raises issues about whether or not the informers are at least in part responsible for potential acts of violence being discussed. On the other hand, there's no doubt that some of these groups are planning acts of violence. And then there's the larger issue of the militia movement, many of whom I think scare me. I'm object to their movement, but I don't think they're engaged in criminal activity. And when, whether it's appropriate for the FBI to be spying on people who, in fact, are not engaged in criminal activity. So it's a very difficult position for the FBI to be in. But their history has been to not be sensitive to civil liberties when it comes to these matters.
Well, Chipper Lay, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Chipper Lay, senior analyst with Political Research Associates in Cambridge, Massachusetts. If people want to go to your website and get information and your research into the right wing, information on the Terry Nichols trial and other cases, where can they go?
It's publicey.org. It's public and then EYE.org. And we have a huge website for people to graze across.
That's www.publicey, one word, EYE, publicey.org. Thanks very much for being with us, Chip.
Thank you.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we return, a profile of the Mexican bishop Samuel Ruiz, well known for his work in Chiapas, in particular San Cristobal de las Casas, and then a look at women in Cuba. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez. Mexico's government-run human rights agency yesterday said it wanted scores of top officials in Chiapas State fired and investigated in connection with the massacre of 45 Indians, a day after the state governor stepped down under pressure following the December 22nd massacre. The National Human Rights Commission urged the state's new governor, Roberto Alvarez, to fire a dozen other top state officials. A group of paramilitaries killed 45 Indian refugees in the village of Actial, most of them women and children, for allegedly supporting the region's pro-Indian Zapatista guerrillas. Critics have said that state and federal government officials knew that paramilitaries were planning attacks on local Indians but failed to stop them. Well, today we're going to look at a central figure in Chiapas. He is the Bishop of San Cristobal de las Casas. His name is Bishop Samuel Ruiz. And in terms of the negotiations that have been on and off taken place between the government and the Zapatista rebels, he has really been at the center. We are joined now by Professor John Womack, a professor of history at Harvard University, who wrote a very interesting piece, a profile of Bishop Ruiz, in a magazine called Double Take. It's called A Bishop's Conversion. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Womack.
Thank you.
Can you tell us who Bishop Samuel Ruiz is?
Well, he is a fellow now of about 70, who was for some years earlier in his career the youngest bishop in Mexico. He came to Chiapas in 1960 as a typical young, devout Mexican anti-communist Catholic cleric, and most concerned then with doing his duty to prevent the spread of sympathies for the Cuban Revolution. He, however, as he lived in Chiapas, he was not from that part of Mexico. He came from another very different region the country. As he did his work there, as he also went off to the Vatican II meetings in Rome in those years, in the early 60s, he really changed in many ways. I think you could see it in part as understanding the world, his world there, in different terms, and also a kind of a deep sense, I think, from his own background came out in him of sympathy with, I guess to put it in, well, simplest terms, sympathy with the downtrodden. And there were no more downtrodden people in Mexico then, or for that matter now, than the Indians and rural poor. And in Chiapas, that often means the same thing. It's not necessarily so in other parts of Mexico, but in Chiapas, the rural poor are mostly Indians, and the Indians are mostly rural poor. As he worked there and tried to understand and live out the mandates of Vatican II and the option for the poor, he organized very skillfully, ably, with much energy and insight into the real problems of these the rural poor in Chiapas, organized really very extensive what they call a catechetical movement. Really, it was to train local people to develop their own catechisms. Now, that sounds a little strange here because, as I remember, my childhood and being taught out of the catechism, it started off something to the effect of who made you, God made me, and so on. But these people that he was in touch with began writing their own catechisms. Some of them turned out to be, in effect, rewritten Indian versions of the Book of Exodus, really stories of struggle, leaving home, of search for the promised land, all in their own Indian languages, and in religious terms that carried a great deal of social, economic, political power. And by the 1970s, early 1980s, they had a very extensive and strong Catholic social movement and programs in Central and Eastern Chiapas.
Well, and, Professor Womack, yeah. You in your article you mentioned that one of the things he tried to do, that Bishop Ruiz tried to do, was redirect the work of the church, which had been pretty much associated with the rich and powerful,
right,
into various works of where he brought in, for instance, Jesuit and other orders of missionaries to come in and in essence become one with the various indigenous communities. Was this more sort of in the direction of the liberation theology of other parts of Latin America? Was this his own sort of homegrown brand of a church that really roots itself in the poor?
I think it was the latter. He certainly knew about liberation theology. He was at the Latin American Bishops' Conference in Medellin in Colombia in 1968. He was and held office for a while in the conference. He knew about missionary programs elsewhere in Latin America, but he's always himself argued that he's not a liberation theologian and that he's not pursuing a liberation theology. But what he has done, I think, is really through the missionary work and the social work that the diocese has supported. What he's done is really create a kind of parallel version of it, and in a way kind of resurrected at least the social side of an old kind of Catholic action program that from the Catholic Church that was really very traditional in the 1920s and 30s, but that he's somehow revived, modernized, and made, I think, effective in social terms in Chiapas. So it's he's, I think, sympathizes certainly, and some other bishops in Mexico and many clerics, Catholic priests and other religious have in the country have would consider themselves liberation theologians.
We're talking to Harvard University professor John Womack, who's written a piece in a magazine called Double Take. Has that come out of the University of North Carolina?
I think it's Duke.
Of Duke University.
Yeah.
And it's a piece he wrote called A Bishop's Conversion. In 1961, Bishop Samuel Ruiz was sent to Chiapas on a spiritual errand. And Professor Womack quotes him as saying, "I came to San Cristobal to convert the poor, but they ended up converting me." I went down to San Cristobal Las Casas to cover the first peace talks between the Zapatistas and the Mexican government right after the uprising in January of 1994. And these first peace talks took place at the Cathedral of San Cristobal, where Samuel Ruiz is the bishop, the cathedral he presides over and works out of. And the question then was that the Mexican government was accusing him of basically being a Zapatista. Now, you wrote in your piece about how it was actually Bishop Ruiz who brought in the core of the Zapatista movement to Chiapas. Can you talk about that and how you learned this? Because it's not something that has been clarified until now.
Well, I don't think he or anybody else really understood what the political connections were of the various groups that appeared in Chiapas in the 70s or 20 years ago. The eastern part of Chiapas, where the Zapatistas had organized most strongly and where their base has been, was one of the most thickly organized parts and politically contested parts of Mexico over the last 20 years. There were organizations of all kinds there. The first of them, I think, dating from this most recent last 20 years or so, was a farm workers union that the Communist Party had begun to organize in these valleys north of San Cristobal, which is where the most recent massacre took place. There were other groups of different ideological directions, all on the left wing, and all doing certain kinds of social work. There was one of sort of Maoist university origins that was trying to organize these Indian communities into unions so that they could bargain much more effectively. Those were, in fact, the first organizers that the bishop began to try to use in matters that were not just local, but that had to do with political negotiations with the state government and organizing on a larger scale than these local deacons and catechetical workers had any experience in doing. There was another group that certainly did not arrive shouting its intention to make a revolution, but that, like the others, came trying to organize unions of either workers or, in their case, trying to organize unions of these so-called ejidos, the Indian communities with lands, or communities that were trying to get lands. Chiapas really was a kind of hotbed of all kinds of organizers. And beginning at some point in the early 80s...
And most of them were operating clandestinely in that they were not visibly members of these political groupings.
That's right. That's right.
So it seems to me that in your article you say that, in essence, what happened that Ruiz, the folks who were working within the church with Ruiz started working with these groups without really knowing their political origins.
That's my sense.
But one of the most fascinating parts of your article is where you mentioned that the Maoist group that had pretty strong ties there, I think it was called the Proletarian Line,
right,
was actually, it seemed to be allied or at least connected with Carlos Salinas, and mm-hmm. that many of its members ended up working in the Solidarity Poverty Program that Salinas' brother, Raul Salinas, directed for many years.
The former president.
Right. Well, yes. Those people, he had been, as a young politician in the system, connected quietly and privately with those people, again, since the mid-70s, since they'd been working in various districts in the northern part of the country. And had stayed in close touch with them. When he eventually wound up in the cabinet, then in the 80s, and then came into the presidency in 88, he had a very strong determination to run a social program along with all the privatization and so on. He had a real strategy for trying to organize a new grassroots movements in the country that would be a base for reforming the PRI from within. And it not only in Chiapas, but in several other important states and regions in the country, these people whom he had been working with for years became the local cadres of the Solidarity organization. As that organization developed nationally, it and had a considerable chunk of the budget. Its character varied in many states and districts because some of it turned out to be pretty corrupt political in the most traditional sense. But there are other regions where really quite seriously a grassroots movement that in effect overthrew the local bosses but stayed within the PRI. Chiapas was one of the places where these people have been working for years and often in knowing rivalries with these guys who then turn out later on to emerge as central in the Zapatista organization and then eventually in the revolt.
And perhaps we saw some of those rivalries come out in the Octal massacre. We just have a minute to go, Professor Womack, and I wanted to ask you about Bishop Ruiz's relationship with Fidel Castro. Our next segment, we're going to be talking about Cuba. The Pope's going there next week. The big subject that we will be seeing in corporate television and in the media will be the relationship of Cuba to the Catholic Church. What is Bishop Ruiz's relationship to Fidel Castro?
So far as I know, there's none. I think
because I know he started out as extremely anti-communist.
Right.
I'm just wondering how he feels today.
Well, I think he probably would feel on the question of Cuba. I in no way could I speak for him. It's not anything I ever asked him about. My sense is that he'd probably feel pretty much about Cuba and Castro the way the Pope does. He would hope that somehow Cuba is able to rejoin the world at large without violence and in peace and preserving as much real justice in its social relations and society as it can.
Well, Professor Womack, we want to thank you for joining us. Professor John Womack of Harvard University, and his piece, A Bishop's Conversion, appears in the latest issue of Double Take, which comes out of Duke University in North Carolina. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute to take a look at women in Cuba. Stay with us. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. And yes, it's just about a week away now, a little over a week, that the Pope will be going to Cuba. And Juan, this may be the last day you're with us live here in the studio. Then next week, you also are headed to Cuba to cover the Pope's visit.
Yes, and I hope to possibly join you by phone a few times while I'm there, yes.
Well, I look forward to that, and also seeing the reaction of the Cuban people to the Pope's visit. I had a chance to go to Cuba last week over the holidays, the New Year's Eve and Christmas holidays, and talk to people about what their expectations were. And over the last week, we've been bringing you listeners on Democracy Now! Excerpts of the conversations that I've had in Cuba. Today, we're going to look at women in Cuba. I had a chance to speak with Norma Vassallo, who is vice chair of the psychology department of the University of Havana and also coordinator of the women's studies department at the university. She's been looking at how women internalize their own self-image, how the outside affects them, and also their own feelings, their own upbringing does. And so I was there with a delegation from Global Exchange, the San Francisco Human Rights Group, and had a chance to talk with her. She was translated by Kathleen Murphy, who is one of the people who works with Global Exchange. She's a U.S. citizen down in Cuba and works also with the San Francisco-based group Food First. She translates for Professor Norma Vassallo as she talks about some of the studies they've done on women in Cuba.
So I've dealt with these issues, researching these issues in women in many different sectors of the society, especially focusing on the issue of women in traditional or non-traditional jobs. And in non-traditional jobs, I focus a lot on women working in construction and other like heavy work, or work with women workers, also with women students, and have interviewed extensively two different generations of housewives, also professional women, trying to figure out or find within them which are the limiting self-perceptions that persevere in spite of these different supposed advances. So one of the most consistent findings is that in spite of the level of social and professional achievement that women have, even women with extremely important positions in society and quite a bit of public status in the society, most women perceive their fundamental role or the most important aspect of their contribution to society in the realm of housewife slash mother slash wife. In looking at the social construction of these perceptions, I focused on women in three different generations. Grandmothers, the rough ages of grandmothers, mothers, and daughters, ages that would roughly correspond to the age of my mother, myself, and my daughter. The grandmothers all had mostly had small children at the point of the revolution coming to power. The mothers were young girls. And the youngest generation, The daughters were born usually around in the decade of the 70s, which after the revolution had already happened and been in power for a decade. So the grandmothers were already had sort of constructed their lives in some significant way at the time that the revolution happened. Whereas the mid-generation women, her generation were children or adolescents when the revolution came to power, at which point education became free and accessible to women, and women were able to enter the public space and the public sphere for the first time. And it wasn't only that the space was open for women if they choose, but it was actually sort of demanded by the society that this is now time for women. The space is opened up for you, and you must step forward. And it was a requirement almost. So this new requirement of this new society was extremely different. But the culture itself, the roots of the culture, remain the same. So at the same time that women were being required to fulfill a public role or move into the public space, the expectations of the private sphere remained the same and were continually reinforced. So what happened with these women that were young when the revolution happened? On the one hand, they were given the opportunity to advance tremendously, both academically and professionally. So these women might feel, on the one hand, or often felt, very fulfilled with their professional and academic achievements. But the more that they, the greater responsibilities, or the more high achieving they were, the less they were able to fulfill their traditional roles and expectations at home. So they had, behind the sense of fulfillment, professional and academic fulfillment, a lot of sense of guilt and frustration for not fulfilling the traditional mother-wife role. And on the other hand, the women who chose to remain housewives felt very frustrated for not having professional or academic stimulation. And so it was a generation of a lot of conflict, of a lot of frustrations on behalf of women, due to the conflict between the new requirements of the new society and the traditional expectations of the culture. One of the things that I've found to be most important in all of these studies, seem to be the most important, is the idea of getting rid of guilt for women releasing guilt. These studies have really reinforced for me how important it is to academically study these things and be able to find these kind of results and work to change the situation, because we need women to be able to feel professionally fulfilled without having the sense of guilt.
You talked about the grandmothers, your generation. What about your daughter and the daughters? Where do they fit in?
The women of the younger generation haven't really taken on or accepted fully these traditional roles in the same way. The impacts of the larger space in the society have definitely had their impact on the culture. And so younger women don't take that traditional, all the weight of the traditional roles on in the same way. But nonetheless, there is the persistence of an important identification with being a mother, with being a wife, and in terms of wanting to please men, objectification around sort of this idea of wife as pleasing men, but this doesn't carry all the weight and the responsibility that it historically did.
Mothers in the United States would find it hard to conceive of a situation where they didn't have to worry about their kids' child care, not to mention health and education. Can you tell us how that has changed women's lives since the revolution?
Yo pienso que, digamos, para las generaciones como la mía,
first of all, for the women of my generation, the whole issue of child care, health care, and education, especially being free for our children, is very important. I was only 6 years old when the revolution happened. I am the daughter of rural farmers, I was a first university graduate in my family, and that was due to the free education brought about by the Cuban Revolution. And in my mind, so I have the Cuban Revolution to thank for my education, for where I've been able to arrive in my life. I also firmly believe that education is the number one step towards women's liberation, because women have to learn how to use their brain or how to be able to identify their own problems and look for solutions. And that's really the first step in women's liberation. For the generations that have been born since the revolution, free healthcare and education are to them just like water is to a fish. The young people don't appreciate these things because many of them feel like it's just like this everywhere. Most young people don't know or have never even had to think about what the price might be for a checkup, a blood analysis, a routine exam, a sophisticated exam, or an extremely sophisticated medical procedure, because they've never had to think about what those things might cost. They just show up, get their treatment, and leave. And it's very difficult in that context to even fully appreciate what free healthcare means. So even though many of the young generation may not fully appreciate the importance of these things, they're extremely important things in a society. And for many mothers, are absolutely important to know that there are free and accessible health services, education services for their children.
The other night, I was interviewing prostitutes outside of discotheques. And there's a growing number of young women who are going into prostitution now because of the growing tourist industry. And I'm wondering if you've looked at that.
Acerca de la prostitución, yo no lo he estudiado.
In terms of prostitution, I haven't studied it directly, but as a professional and as a person, I certainly have opinions about prostitution. I think it's very connected to the, it's what's definitely connected to the economic crisis. And has something that has appeared in the years of the crisis. But although the economic crisis affects most women in the same degree, there are many different ways to look for solutions. And although all women in Cuba are affected by the crisis, only all women look for different ways to resolve the issues that they face as a result of the crisis, and only a very small percentage of women look for those solutions through prostitution. So I think that there are other issues involved in prostitution as well, not only looking for economic benefits. I think a lot of it is very related to self-esteem, levels of self-esteem that women have, which may sometimes come from or originate in their family of origin, and sort of their hopes for themselves in life, their long-term feelings of being able to achieve something in life. Because there are other, in this period of crisis, there are other ways for women to make money, to make dollars. For example, the cuenta propia work, self-employment work that's been being increasingly legalized, which many categories of self-employment are earning women quite a good income today in Cuba. So I think that in terms of why women do it, economically speaking, as you've interviewed some of these women, you've probably found that many of them are studying in the university, many of them are university graduates, many of them have other jobs, have regular jobs, and it's not the same kind of prostitution that exists in other countries in Latin America or the Third World, which is a prostitution absolutely based in survival, where women are involved in prostitution to be able to eat. And although some women here say that that's true for them, when you think about what you can do in Cuba with $100, maybe you would need to, you know, be involved, you know, to prostitute yourself maybe once a year to be able to, you know, if you're really looking at the issue of food. But then you know, if you're talking about women who are wearing expensive perfume and wearing very expensive clothes, it's sort of a whole other issue. I know that there are many women here and around the world who feel like prostitution is just another job, like any job. I know that there's even movements in the world that promote that idea. I personally don't believe that. I don't think it's just another job. I think that when women have to sell their bodies or profit off the sale of their bodies as an employment, it's a very damaging thing for them. And I think that, so it's not another job, just another job in my mind. And I think that especially in a country where we have laws and achievements to be able to try and prevent the need for something like prostitution, which no one should have to do. That should never have to be a job for anyone. And especially in a country that has achieved certain laws to be able to prevent women needing to be involved in prostitution, it's very sad and painful for the country. And the society has a great responsibility to these women and to dealing with this issue, and it's mostly in the realm of education.
The Pope is coming to town in a few weeks. He is fiercely against abortion and sex education, which are both legal and advocated in Cuba. What does that mean for women?
Esperamos que ninguna. En Cuba el aborto está despenalizado desde mucho antes.
We hope it won't have any influence at all. In the first place, abortion was decriminalized in Cuba before 1959, and at that time, when it was illegal in the U.S., women, many women, came to Cuba to have abortions here. So, and also, you know, the Cuban people aren't really Catholic as such. There's a Catholic church, but the Catholicism was never a popular religion, and not since 59, but before 59, since pre-59. The Catholic church was never a popular church in the sense that it is and has been in Central America. I like to say that in Cuba, people are superstitious, not religious. I think if the Pope were to come and do some lobbying on these issues in Cuba, he wouldn't get anywhere. It would be bad for him. If the Pope comes and starts proselytizing about how bad it is to have abortions, use abortions and birth control, people it's going to be reflect negatively upon him, because birth control is very, very widely used, is free and accessible in Cuba, and abortion is too widely used. We want it to be free and accessible, but not to be used as a method of birth control, which sometimes it appears to be considered.
What is the average number of abortions a woman has in her lifetime?
No me sé ese dato. No lo conozco, pero la práctica del aborto, bueno, es algo que aquí se
hace un trabajo. I know that we're doing a lot of work right now to encourage women to use birth control and to avoid unwanted pregnancies rather than having to deal with them. I just want to interject. Someone told me it was like 2.5, 2.7 or something like that, which I don't know if it's that different from the States. Because like in the Soviet Union, it was like 8 or 10. It's not that high here.
What kind of birth control is encouraged here, as used?
Los dispositivos intrauterinos.
IUDs.
From where?
No sé, pero ese es un problema que tenemos ahora entre los muchos productos.
I'm not sure exactly where they're made, what country they come from, or if we've been able, or if Cuba has established a production site here, but it's one of the, but the use is quite common of IUDs, but it's also birth control methods or apparatus or one of the things that have suffered among many, many things in the special period, that there's not enough condoms, diaphragms, and IUDs.
Psychology professor Norma Vasallo of the University of Havana in Cuba in conversation last week when I was down in Cuba. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with help from Sammy Lee Webster-Woog. Errol Maitland is our engineer, Julie Drizin our executive producer. More Cuba conversations throughout the week leading up to the Pope's visit. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.